The following is a Comfortably Zoned Radio Network production.
Thank you, Tally Olson. I am back. You are comfortably zoned in Alameda, California, with me, the Zigzag Man, Ralph Zig Tycho. And as usual, I have the most interesting guests on the planet. And what I really like is returning guests, which shows me that they enjoyed the first time. And without further ado, author, freelance author, Dan Epstein, how are you?
Hey, Ralph. I'm good, man. How are you doing?
You know, no complaints. I'm still kicking it at age 76.
God bless.
To give you an idea of how kicking I am, I bought what's known as a pitch bag.
Oh, yeah.
In my backyard. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I used to have one. Are you kidding?
Oh, then you realize.
As a kid, I used to practice my knuckleball on that thing.
Right. And you wonder how a knuckleball would come back based on the theory of that. It really develops your skills. I mean, you got to throw it right to get it back right. And it's revolutionized my exercise routine.
Excellent.
I go out there for an hour and a half a day, an hour, 45 minutes, let's put it that way. And I enjoy it. It's there are times I just use it to meditate, where you're just throwing the ball back. Other times you want to work out, you get a little challenge. It isn't necessarily aerobic, which is a good thing when you're 76. You don't need to blow out my heart to get a little exercise. Anyway, that's how I'm doing, and I'm completing my second book, which is my idea is to make it an audio book and nothing else. Because what it is, it's a compilation of interviews that I did. I've got about 50 of them. The topic being loving baseball when you were 12 and innocent. And it works as an audiobook because I'm getting to hear emotion from people, passion from people on a podcast that needs to be transcended to an audiobook. And almost complete. I've got about 49 interviews. I'm striving for 50. So what I'd like is for you to be number 50. And not today, another time. We'll get together on the phone. And I want to know what it was like for you at age 12. I'm just curious.
Well, sure, but it's funny because Joe Pepitone actually plays into that in my case, because Pepitone was retired by the time I was 12 years old. I was 12 in 1978, and I had heard of him, you know, because he'd played for the Yankees and, you know, and had been in the World Series in the 60s and all this, but I really had no idea about who he was or, you know, what kind of a character he was. And then in the summer of 78, when I was at the peak of my baseball madness, I was checking every baseball-related book I could find at my local branch of the LA Public Library. And actually, I remember I was with my mom, and she pulled Joe, You Could Have Made Us Proud out of the shelf. And she said, oh, Joe Pepitone was a baseball player. Maybe you'd like to read this. So I took it home and expecting just another kind of, you know, mildly entertaining baseball story about a guy and the guys he played against. And had no idea that there was going to be, you know, gun violence, you know, mob involvement, all kinds of sexual stuff. And boy, was my mind blown. And so
at
pretty
age
much
12,
at
that's
age 12,
the year
so.
We lose our innocence and intellect becomes mixed with passion for baseball. And you're accumulating intellect at a mile a minute at that age. And I'll bet that that taught you enough to know the real world of baseball and not be surprised later on.
Am oh, I yeah. Right? No, I mean, I had already read Ball 4 at that point. So it's like I was, you know, aware of the difference between, you know, that space between the baseball myth and baseball reality. But Joe Pepitone's book was way more hardcore than Ball 4.
Oh,
And it really blew my mind. And certainly I was getting to that age where I was just about as interested in girls as I was in baseball, and that sort of and that kind
right.
of played into it as well. So yeah, no, it was that was I mean, to this day, that's still probably my favorite baseball book written by a player. It's
real. My favorite chapter is when he talks about getting high with Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford. Cannabis high, and they were playing an Army game. The Yankees went up to play Army at West Point, and
right.
I think that was the setting for that. And Mantle was so blitzed out of his mind that he ended up hitting a home run that game.
But after striking out three straight times.
Well, it's like pitch back. You throw it good, you get it back, you miss it. Baseball, playing pitch back high, I mean. So they tell me, by golly. You're absolutely right. You wrote the article, a definitive article about him in the Rolling Stone. What did you learn about him that you didn't find out in the book about him personally, about his, because he was kind of an eclectic guy. He was complicated.
He was very complicated, and you know, and I knew that going in, but you know, I mean, there are certain things I learned that, you know, just like factual stuff, like about how when he was playing with the Cubs, the bleacher bums used to like wad up drugs in like tinfoil pouches or sandwich bags and throw them to him when he was playing the outfield. And he would then pick them up and stash them in the ivy and would then, you know, when the game was long over, he would then like sneak out of the clubhouse and go extricate the gifts from the ivy. So there was,
you know,
stuff like that.
What's
that
kind
I
of funny, I met Hank Sauer back in the day, and Hank Sauer played with the Cubs and was a real hero in Chicago.
Yep.
And they would throw him bubble gum that he would put in the ivy and save for later. That's a reflection of how times changed
Yes, they were throwing cocaine to Joe, and he was saving that for later. So that kind of stuff. But also, you know, it was just really interesting to talk to him and see, like, what, I mean, he, you know, was very aware of how much he'd screwed up in his life and how many, you know, whether it's his relationships or his career. You know, he was not defensive at all about that. He was not, you know, he, you know, there was a sadness about it, but there was also kind of like, he still had his sense of humor about it. You know, it's just kind of like, well, you know, what could I do? This is who I am. This is the life that, you know, I was born into. And, you know, I mean, he was obviously really scarred by his, you know, from his upbringing. You know, with a very hard-nosed dad in, you know, an Italian community in Brooklyn, and, you know, really kind of, I mean, you can get into all kinds of stuff about, like, the toxic masculinity of that scenario and how, you know, Joe, who was basically like a sweet, sensitive kid, got, you know, really, you know, that was not a good environment for him. But, you know, it was really interesting to talk to him and just, like, you know, see, like, what kind of, you know, what a sweet, empathetic guy he was, but also, like, how, you know, he was still struggling. I mean, this was, like, 7 years ago, like, you know, so he would have been in his mid-70s, and he was still really kind of struggling with, you know, his legacy and what he'd done and the damage he'd caused and, you know, was trying to kind of get to a place of peace with it, I guess.
Peace with him and within himself, which is not necessarily with the world. He was the kind of guy, take me or leave me. But it's nice to know that he was empathetic in that way towards himself. And he could reflect. He could look within himself and reflect. Because, you know, life is a mixed bowl of nuts.
Yeah.
And all we have to do is get as many cashews as we can. And he didn't have many cashews at an early age.
No.
For those of you, we haven't mentioned, for those of you who don't know, Joe Pepitone, former Yankee, former Chicago Cub, among other teams, but mostly the Yankees, passed away this past week. And it's a blow to everybody who grew up knowing of his legacy or actually seeing him. I got to see him play. He was a damn good first baseman, and an excellent center fielder when Mantle had to go to first, or they thought he had to go to first. It didn't really help much, but they got a young guy out there with some range, and he was a Gold Glove caliber center fielder, and he had demons.
Yes.
Speaking of which, when you said, mentioned his upbringing, a poor guy with an overbearing father and all this, that really doesn't excuse how one turns out, that sort of thing. Because the first thing I thought of was the Torrey brothers, who grew up in Brooklyn in poverty with a shitty fatherly figure. And they turned out presumably different.
I'm not making excuses for Joe. And you know, and frankly, I don't think Joe was making excuses for Joe. But I think, you know, but it also goes beyond his dad. I mean, he, you know, from a very early age was, you know, kind of mixed up with, you know, the wise guys. And, you know, even when he was just starting out with the Yankees, like, there were, you know, there were guys from the mob who were offering to kneecap Bill Scourin so that Joe could take his place at first. And, you know, Joe had
to. That's incredible to hear that because Scourin took over. Joe Pepitone took over. Scourin was going through some real tough times. Divorce, if I'm not mistaken. And at the same time, he loved the Yankees, like Johnny Blanchard, Sturtevant, those guys.
Yeah.
They were crushed when they had to leave. Billy Martin is a good example of that.
Yeah.
And there was something about the Yankee era, the Yankee tradition, DiMaggio, Gary, you know, that just that got to people. And Scourin was about to lose his job anyway and gets traded. And to know that there were people that he was associating with people that would even offer that, whether or not he brought it on, I doubt that. Somehow.
No, he actually told them, you know, like, no, I want to do this the right way. Don't mess with them. But basically Joe came from that culture and, you know, and more than just his dad, it's just like you had all these guys who, you know, had a very specific idea of the way, like, a guy comports himself, the way a guy, you know, kind of puts on a show when he goes out to a nightclub or a restaurant. And you know, I mean, Ron Bloomberg, who I did a book with on Thurman Munson, told me a story about, like, how, you know, he knew Joe a bit in his early Yankee days and just, like, and he made the mistake of going out with him once. And it's just like, it was such a circus that, like, you know, you really just didn't want to hang out with him because you didn't know who else was going to show up at the table. You didn't know, like, you know, what kind of trouble was going to occur. And of course, you know, Joe was always, like, putting on a show, trying to impress people, you know, picking up everybody's tab, you know, going broke in the process. So, I mean, I think he felt a lot of pressure to live up to this persona and didn't really understand that he didn't have to do that. And, you know, and I suspect certainly a lot of guys, a lot of Italian guys of his generation, you know, were up against something similar. And, you know, and maybe the Torre brothers were, you know, were outliers in that, or maybe they just, you know, had better grounding or what, but, you know, Joe bought into it, you know, hook, line and sinker, and, really, you know, screwed up his career and his life as a result.
Right. But, overall, he could say one thing: I did it my way.
Yeah.
And he wasn't dissuaded from that. Do you have any stories about Pepitone's relationship with Leo DeRocher?
Yeah, they had a very difficult relationship. I mean, not that Leo was, you know, easy for anybody to get along with, but they had a whole thing with you know, Joe was really into riding motorcycles at that time and, like, you know, kept bringing his motorcycle into the Cubs clubhouse at Wrigley, which DeRocher was not into. And so they had a lot of issues over that. And then, you know, there was the whole thing where, you know, Joe was already in some financial trouble at this point, and so was trying to get the Cubs to, you know, pay him more money so he could, you know, both pay off some of his debts and live the lifestyle that he was accustomed to by this point. And when the Cubs management, who are of course not known for being exceptionally generous with their money, kind of balked at that, then he started, acting out. He was not showing up for games. There was that period where he opened a bar on Division Street in Chicago, Joe Pepitone's thing, and where he decided, that's it. I'm retiring from baseball. I'm just going to be a nightclub owner. And, so I think DeRocher was really beside himself because, here's this guy. And, and Pepitone had some great periods with the Yankees, or not the Yankees, with the Cubs. Like 1971, he hit 307, I think 16 home runs. He was really a difference maker of a player. And then all of a sudden he wasn't showing up for games, or he was going fishing for a week, or things like this. And so, you can't really blame DeRocher for getting upset, because he needed to be able to rely on his players, and Joe was anything but reliable at this point.
Well, as you know, Leo DeRocher fit the category of Joe Pepitone in his time. He frustrated a lot of managers, but Branch Rickey. So he had two people that are that close in personality sometimes clash on the road.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And DeRocher certainly liked to hang out with the tough guys. I mean, both DeRocher and Pepitone were friends of Frank Sinatra. So there's definitely a lot of common ground there.
Yeah. What do you miss about the days? I'm going to segue a little bit. You wrote an iconic book on baseball, Funky Hair.
And, Big Hair.
And
Big Hair and Plastic Grass.
It was the story of the 70s. And at that time, incredible changes were going on, not just in baseball, but in society. We'd been through or in the middle of Vietnam at the beginning of the 70s. And were there days that were there times in those days that you miss now?
Oh, yeah.
Were there times that you ever heard a more poorly phrased question? But you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, for one thing, I mean, that was the era that I fell in love with baseball in. So, I think there is I wrote this in Big Hair and Plastic Grass, where I think that there is that tendency, and this goes along with your 12-year-old theory, which is like, that era when you first really fall hard for the game is always going to be your golden era, and so for me it was the 70s, and one of the reasons I wrote that book was I felt like that period had been kind of overlooked by a lot of baseball historians. Despite the fact that there were so many important changes that happened in the game and so many iconic players who were part of it during the 70s. But the thing was that it was weird. It didn't fit the narrative of the 50s and the 60s. And there were all kinds of social change elements that were coming into the game or that the game was reflecting, whether it was, the way the players were wearing their hair, or whether it was, the colorful polyester uniforms,
or free agency itself.
Yeah, free agency itself, which is still like a major, has a major impact on the game, and that started in the 70s. So I felt that a book needed to be written to really kind of put all that, in perspective and in context, but also to celebrate it, because I felt that the few times, I would see things like in Ken Burns' documentary, baseball, like, you know, it was the 70s were just like kind of a quick pit stop on the way to the 80s. It was like, okay, Frank, you know, Hank Aaron hits, you know, breaks Babe Ruth's record. Carlton Fisk hits that crazy home run in one of the greatest World Series games ever played. Pete Rose has the hitting streak in 78. Let's move on. And, you know, and I just felt like it deserved so much more attention. And I really do think that, you know, that book did help kind of shift the focus. And, you know, I think a lot more people appreciate what the 70s meant to baseball now, and just like what a rich, rich decade it was.
Yes. Thank you for chronicling it. I appreciate it. As a baseball fan, it is right up there. And there are a number of books, I must say, but the number isn't as you're included in that number, and it isn't that great a number. I mean, between you and Peter Golenbach and a number of others, for my reading, Jim Brosnan when I was a kid.
Oh yeah, those are great books.
And you talk about how baseball and life are the same. He writes the time when he's down in the St. Louis dugout bullpen, and he looks out, and there comes his wife and his baby in arms. And there's a game going on. And she says, she comes down to the railing and says, "You take him. I can't take him anymore." So it humanized to me at maybe age 12 when I was reading that book. It made me realize that these people are not Apple cards or Stratomatic cards and stuff. They're human beings just doing what, doing their thing, their only talent sometimes. And that life has got to get in the way, good, bad, and ugly.
Absolutely.
So I'd just like to say, I'm going to miss Joe Pepitone for the memory that in 1969, my podcast partner, Jack DeGraw, was at the doubleheader when Pepe hit a home run each game and they won each game.
Nice.
And my grandfather was very old, and there were very few things that made him happy at that age. Just because of what he was going through physically, just getting old.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to him on the phone from California shortly after I got out of the Air Force, shortly after I decided to stay in California, and shortly before he died. And it was one of the last times I spoke to him, and I heard the glistening in his voice when he reported Pepitone's doubleheader and the Yankees winning both games and this, that, and the other thing. So I thank his spirit for that. So what can I say?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, and like you said earlier, I mean, he really did, you know, for better or worse, he lived life his way, but he was very, you know, he was very real about it. And, you know, one of the reasons that I think of him as this kind of 70s icon. I mean, he was really, he was behaving like a lot of players did in the 70s, but he was doing it in the 60s. He was, you know, he was the first guy to bring a hairdryer into the clubhouse at a time when that was considered a very unmanly thing to do. He would get his uniform pants tailored so that they fit him tighter, you know, to you know, for the female fans in the stands' enjoyment. He was, you know, he was a prankster. He was, you know, very, you know, he had a men's suit shop for a while. You know, I mean, he lived in a much more colorful way than ball players typically did at that period. So I see him as this kind of, you know, proto 70s icon. Who you know, and then of course all his crazy hair pieces that he would wear on and off the field. He told me actually in our interview that he actually even had an Afro hairpiece during the 70s, which I would love to see a photo of. I've never actually been able to find one. But you know, it's just like he was a colorful dude, and you know, you asked me like, do I miss that period of time? I mean, I miss colorful players. I miss guys who, you know, have a personality, who aren't, you know, just kind of robotic, you know, performers, and, you know, and actually get up to interesting stuff off the field as well as on. And, you know, Joe really embodied that.
Well, you know what you and Ron Bloomberg have in common? Two Jews from the South.
Well, I'm not really from the South. I live in North Carolina
You're living in Greensboro. And,
no, not anymore. I was living in Greensboro. I'm in New York now.
Oh, okay. Welcome back. Tell me what was different about the South that you found pleasurable and weren't expecting.
Well, good question. I mean, I used to spend a lot of summers in Alabama when I was a kid. My grandfather was the dean of the School of Social Work at University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa. So, it wasn't like I was stranger to the South. And certainly North Carolina was much less, quote unquote, Southern than Alabama. You know, and maybe that's it. Maybe, you know, North Carolina, you know, I mean, everybody in my family seemed to think that I was going to, that there were going to be cross burnings on my lawn when I moved to North Carolina. But in reality, North Carolina is a very, you know, at least in the larger cities, is pretty progressive. It's pretty, what's the term I'm looking for? You know, it's very diverse culturally, and you know, you get out to the sticks, and then it's you know, a little more the meth labs and you know, Trump flags. But you know, but you know, in Greensboro is a college town with a long history of civil rights activism, and you know, going back to before the Civil War. I mean, it was a big Quaker town, and the Quakers were very involved in the abolitionist movement. So, you know, so I think it's, you know, I always hate it when people, you know, try to stereotype a particular state or a particular region in a certain way, because, you know, it's not a monoculture. There's all kinds of people, there's all kinds of things going on. And you know, North Carolina is a very, you know, very fascinating, beautiful state. And if I hadn't gotten divorced, I probably would be there now.
Okay. What brought you back to New York?
My dad's in New York City and my mom's in Kingston. And I just thought at this point in my life and at this point in their lives, I wanted to be closer to them.
Good. Good. Be healthy and be happy, whatever you do.
Thank you.
You're a terrific guest, and I'm honored that you come back.
Well, I'm honored to be asked, Ralph. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, Dan. Dan Epstein, Comfortably Zoned Radio. I'm Ralph Tycho, the weak link of it all, but I am a damn good producer sometimes, as witnessed by a terrific interview. Great. Again, I thank you. Thank you all for listening. Stay well. Sei gesund. And adios and happy trails.
Right on, Ralph. Have a good one.
Adios.
The proceeding has been a Comfortably Zoned Network production. You are advised to keep your dreams wet, your humor dry, your children and grandchildren out of military recruiting offices and off the laps of clerics who wear dresses. Thank you for listening, everyone. Happy trails.